Welcome to The Baton, a John Williams musical journey. Join host Jeff Cummings as he takes you through the career of the illustrious film composer John Williams, starting with his debut in 1959 through more than 100 films in 60 years. Our episode today listens to the music from Empire of the Sun, made in 1987. Now here's your host, Jeff Cummings.
I hope you're having a great day, and it's wonderful to have you here for this episode of The Baton. Before I start talking about the featured film in this episode, I want to talk about a little side project Williams took on right around the time he was working on The Witches of Eastwick, which I discussed with John Maria Caschetto in the previous episode. This side project was Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. And until recording this episode, I was completely unaware that John Williams had any involvement in it. I have to give a lot of thanks to James Allman and Michael Pierce for making me aware of this, because without them, I would have gone the rest of my life thinking Williams wanted nothing to do with the Superman films after the debacle of Superman II when he had that falling out with replacement director Richard Lester. And since Lester directed Superman III, Williams certainly wasn't going to write the score for that. But when Superman IV came around with a new director, Williams seemed to consider returning to the franchise, but he was too busy with The Witches of Eastwick. His very good friend, Alexander Courage, was hired as composer on the recommendation of Williams himself. That was a strange recommendation, since Courage was working exclusively as an orchestrator for movies and hadn't composed any original music in more than a decade. In fact, he was one of the orchestrators for The Witches of Eastwick that year, and had been the main orchestrator for Williams' score since the early 70s. As a condition of working on the score, Courage convinced Williams to help out with some thematic material. Williams submitted three themes for the film, one of which does not appear in any of the film versions. That one is called Jeremy's Theme, used for the boy who pleads with Superman to get rid of all the world's nuclear weapons. When Superman IV got whittled down from 2 hours and 14 minutes to just 89 minutes, a lot of scenes and plot lines were removed, including this boy, Jeremy. Because there was no soundtrack release of the combined Williams and Courage score, very few outside of the music department personnel knew Jeremy had a theme. That is, until Mike Matassino uncovered the theme when starting work on a 2008 box set of all the Superman scores. Here's a bit of Jeremy's theme. Now, when you think of Superman themes, the love theme for Superman and Lois Lane from the original Superman movie comes immediately to mind. And not even Williams could surpass himself on that theme, though he tried with a quasi-love theme for a character named Lacey in Superman IV. Thank you. And then the final theme is probably the best one. It's for the villain of the film named Nuclear Man, created when a bomb explodes in the sun. Williams hadn't really written anything this brassy and bold for the movie since Temple of Doom, so it's a welcome addition for those who disregard his work in this period as too quiet and introspective. These three themes were to appear on the soundtrack release, and when that didn't happen, the music just sat in a vault, forgotten until the 2008 box set. I never purchased that box set, thinking that I didn't want to have 8 CDs of music, the majority of which I thought had no original John Williams music. I was wrong, and again, I have to give a big thanks to James and Michael for that heads up. This wouldn't be the last time Williams would write music for a film, then let another composer take the reins. We'll talk about that with Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets in particular. So let's move on to Empire of the Sun, and for that we have to go back to 1985 to start that discussion. Steven Spielberg was having a midlife crisis in 1985. He was 1 year away from turning 40, he had just become a father, and he was pressured by those close to him to grow up, to stop making fantasy films and make a serious movie. But he was resisting that as his inner child continued to make him a very famous and very rich man. Universal Studios had just the project that would get him to switch his outlook on making movies. The novel Schindler's List was a hot property in the mid-1980s, and Spielberg was at the top of the list to direct it. But Spielberg said he wasn't ready to tackle a movie about the Holocaust. Instead, he was convinced to direct The Color Purple, a 180-degree turn from Indiana Jones and The Temple of Doom, the movie he worked on before that. He managed to make a great movie that had no explosions, aliens, or melting faces. "I saw the world through much different eyes when Max was born," Spielberg later said about the birth of his first child that took place during the filming of The Color Purple. But as his 2-year stint as creator of the Amazing Stories series on TV made clear, he still wanted to feed the child inside him, and when it came time to pick his next film, Spielberg tried to placate studio executives and himself with the tale of a young boy who grows up during World War II. The plot of Empire of the Sun seemed straightforward. It was a semi-autobiographical tale of a British boy named Jim who spends almost 4 years in a Japanese internment camp, and Spielberg chose to view the war through the lens of a child. He gathered all of his regular collaborators for this film, who worked hard to make Spielberg's vision a reality. One of the major achievements of the movie was filming in Shanghai, making Empire of the Sun the first non-Chinese film to shoot there. And casting Christian Bale as Jim was a major feat, a choice that the novel's author J.G. Ballard approved. This was Bale's first theatrical film after acting in 3 TV movies in England in 1986, and he does so well in playing a naive child who transforms into a mature teenager. It was a minor transformation compared to the others he would famously make later in his career. As always, the last piece of the puzzle is the music. Spielberg and John Williams managed to click easily after the hiccup in their working relationship that was The Color Purple. By all accounts, Williams had lots of ideas for the score. He understood the film being told from a child's perspective and would write music to fit that perspective. If you watch the film, you'll see that Spielberg was a bit aimless in his direction, particularly in establishing the right tone, and it was one of the major sticking points for critics who bashed the film in 1987. The simple fact is that it is hard to understand what the film is trying to say. You feel that there is an underlying tone of the loss of innocence through the horrors of war, and how a child's perspective can make even World War II seem a little less tragic. But the problem is that another film about the same topic was released earlier in the year, called Hope and Glory, and critics like Gene Siskel didn't shy away from comparing the two. This is what Gene Siskel said, quote, "You got a movie made by John Borman called Hope and Glory that was just released that is much better and much more daring in showing the whimsy that children's view of war is. On the other hand, this film, Empire of the Sun, wants to hedge its bet and make it like an adventure film, so you've got like Indiana Jones with the John Malkovich character helping the little kid through all the fun of war. I don't know what Spielberg wanted to do." And that's the end of the quote from Gene Siskel. Now, I only point this out because it becomes clear that Spielberg's lack of focus for the film had a major effect on the score. Williams didn't write a wall-to-wall score for Empire of the Sun, but there are large portions of the 50 minutes or so that he wrote that were sliced from the final cut. This is not a new occurrence, of course, as Williams' score for 1941 got some heavy re-editing and post-production. But in that case, music was rearranged after scenes were either cut or moved around. I don't get the sense that this happened on Empire of the Sun, though. It appears that Spielberg's thoughts about certain parts of the score in the film changed once he heard it with the visuals. Though some might argue that the anchor for the score are the two choral pieces that I will talk about later, I think the music really hinges on the thematic material written for Jim. Its presence isn't as prevalent as other main themes in Williams' previous work, but it appears in a few key scenes. Its first appearance comes on the flute during the first moment of underscore in the film, when Jim is in bed talking with his parents about a dream he had. Played on the flute, this obviously makes Jim's theme very childlike. We'll hear another use of it later. Many other characters surround Jim in Empire of the Sun, but because there's very little score, we get no other major instrumental themes. If you own the 2014 CD release of the score, you have read the very in-depth analysis and breakdown of the score by Mike Matesino. In it, he believes that the sparse musical moments in the film are meant to come from Jim's mind, and not from the external composer of a dramatic film. Quote, "It is Jim's own score for his own picture," Matesino writes, as if Jim Graham is making a picture about his life, and he decides to keep music out of the parts that are too real. It's an interesting perspective, but I'd like to flip that thinking as a choice by Spielberg, and maybe also by Williams, to make Empire of the Sun more like a documentary retelling of Jim's life and World War II. Only when moments become heightened is there a need for underscore. This is the first time Spielberg and Williams use this tactic. Although it's not completely effective here, it will be used very well in Spielberg's future World War II films. Now I'm going to illustrate this through five examples. And the first comes during the very dramatic scene when Jim is separated from his parents in the chaos of the Japanese invasion. There's music pretty much during the entire scene, but a lot of it is hard to hear in the film over screams and occasional gunfire.
Thank you.
Williams does bring up the tension at the exact moment Jim lets go of his mother's hand with an explosion on the brass instruments. That's probably the most intense moment in the movie, though the sound mixers could have done better to balance the crowd noise and music in the film. The sound mixers received an Academy Award nomination for this film, but I would not have given it to them because of the poor blending of the score into the sound mix. My second example of Williams' music coming in only to heighten the drama comes when Jim returns home after his separation. No one is there, and we get a sequence of scenes in which he rides his bike in the house, eats all the canned food, and retrieves objects from the drained swimming pool. The music is here primarily because there is no dialogue in this sequence, just Jim waiting for his parents to return. Now pay attention to this melody played in the strings. Those wavering notes in the strings sounded very familiar to me as I heard them play the film, and it perked up my ears even more when I heard it on the soundtrack album. It's a melody that Williams will return to in AI Artificial Intelligence. Listen. So, on to my third example of the score only coming in for big movie moments. One of the most lasting images from the film is the shot of Jim admiring a Japanese plane while sparks fly from welders all around him. It's a beautiful moment, and it definitely is one of the reasons why Alan Davio's cinematography received an Oscar nomination. It's a moment that feels like it was made for the movie and not really part of the documentary portion. This is the big moment for Jim's theme, and it will build to a grand statement, complete with choir, as Jim salutes the Japanese pilots. Now, we've segued to about 3 years later at the internment camp when Jim makes a friend of a Japanese boy on the other side of the barbed wire fence. There's a scene when Jim goes under the barbed wire fence to set a trap for pheasants. There's much more to the scene than that, though, as the adult prisoners believe the Japanese planted mines on the other side of the fence to keep prisoners from escaping, and Jim is the guinea pig. The music comes in as we see Jim crawl through the weeds and dirty water, just as one of the Japanese prison guards spots Jim's shoes and searches for him. This music reminds me of what Williams wrote about 20 years earlier for None But the Brave to underscore the Japanese soldiers sneaking up on the crashed American plane. Using Japanese instrumentation, including the shakuhachi flute, it perfectly tells us where the danger lies. And then there is Cadillac of the Skies. If you know the score from the concert suite named Cadillac of the Skies, you might think that the entire piece of music accompanies this scene. But the concert suite is mostly made of music from the plane scene earlier with the sparks flying everywhere. But parts of the music from this scene make up the concert suite as well. So Jim gets excited when an American P-51 strafes the Japanese hangar from across the camp, calling the plane Cadillac of the Skies. It's surprising that the music doesn't feature Jim's theme, but it is nonetheless exciting for about a minute and a half. camp's doctor tells Jim to stop cheering for the planes, and this brings Jim back to a reality where the orchestra is still playing, but more subdued. So, let's talk about the use of chorus in this film. The idea started with a Welsh song called Swogan that producers Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall discovered in pre-production and wanted to use heavily in the film. John Williams was on board with it, and he used the Ambrosian Junior Choir to record the song, which is played 3 times in the film as a piece to highlight childish innocence, or the loss thereof in its final performance. This song was to be lip-synced by Christian Bale in the film twice, so it needed to be recorded before filming began in March 1987. The plan to use Swogan as a pivotal musical theme in the film planted the seed in Williams' head to make us feel like the choir used for that song spills over into the underscore. When Williams began recording the actual score in Hollywood in October, he used a chorus of nearly 80 singers to express that idea. In addition to supplying wordless melodies throughout the score, such as what you heard in the scene when Jim admires the Japanese plane, the chorus also performed a quasi-original piece by John Williams called Exultate Justi, which uses words from Psalm 33 against a minor theme used in the underscore. For many years, I thought Exultate Justi was a very old piece written long before Williams was born. And that's how great the composition is. It fits as a bookend to the 200-year-old Swogan, sounding like it was written in the same period. The piece is played first when Jim returns to the camp after it has been deserted, and he finds Freedom riding his bicycle through the camp without worry. I love the blending of Western and Eastern sounds in there, reflecting the two worlds Jim lives in throughout the film. And it's great that Exultate Justi plays over the end credits, though a fully fleshed out composition using Jim's theme would have been wonderful. So the score suffered in the final version, but it still had plenty of standout moments to proclaim it as another top-notch Williams composition. It was a nominee for original score at the Oscars alongside The Witches of Eastwick, losing to the unstoppable film The Last Emperor and its score that also had issues with finding a constant flow throughout the film. And just like 1941, Empire of the Sun had its ardent followers, and those who proclaim it as a misstep. Even Spielberg claimed that he didn't expect it to be a hit, insinuating that he was pretty much making the movie for himself. It wasn't going to have a broad audience appeal, Spielberg said in 1989, and I've earned the right to fail commercially. But pretty much everyone came away from this movie unscathed. Christian Bale was praised everywhere for holding the film together. It seemed like he was on a path to becoming a very good child actor, but things didn't really take off for him until he became an adult. There was the role opposite Winona Ryder in 1994's Little Women, but things particularly changed with American Psycho in 1999, leading all the way up to playing Batman and winning an Academy Award in 2011 for The Fighter. And starring alongside Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun was Ben Stiller, making his film debut. After he wrapped the so-called failure that was Empire of the Sun, Spielberg did have to finish his deal directing three Indiana Jones films, so that seemed like the next logical film to make. And while Spielberg was working on that, Williams took the time to work on the score for a film based on a novel he had enjoyed reading. That film is The Accidental Tourist, and I'm very excited to be bringing back Maurizio Caschetto as a co-host for that episode. As always, I invite you to send me your comments via email to jeffswim@aol.com and to also write a review on iTunes. So let's close out this episode by saying, until next time, the baton is down.